The headlines: Iran celebrating the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, which overthrew the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The growing row over Ukraine, Russia says it will not give in to U.S. sanctions threats, using Washington of generating tensions. And a third day of protests paralyzing traffic in Canada's capital city. Truck drivers block the streets near Parliament to protest vaccine mandates. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. 43 years since the Islamic Revolution, Iran is celebrating a popular uprising that toppled the Western-backed monarch. Festivities known as the 10-Day Dawn start with ceremonies that mark the return to Iran of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, after 15 years in exile. Millions of Iranians welcomed the charismatic leader in Tehran on February 1, 1979. Imam Khomeini's arrival intensified months of popular protests against the Pahlavi regime. 10 days later, the rallies culminated in the downfall of the regime, bringing the curtain down on more than two millennia of monarchy in Iran.
A spiritual leader who maintained a simple lifestyle. Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was born in the city of Khomein on September 24, 1902. He grew up in a family with a long tradition of religious scholarship. He received early Quranic education at home and local schools, and pursued his later studies at Islamic seminaries until he became marja, or a source of emulation, a highly prominent authority in religious law. Imam Khomeini soon rose to fame as an anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism icon. He became politically active when, in 1963, the then US-backed monarch of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, launched a program of reforms known as the White Revolution. The plan was an American-inspired package of measures designed to prop up the regime and nip any voices of dissent in the bud, all in the name of promoting the rights of citizens. Imam Khomeini was the first religious leader who openly condemned the Shah's program of westernization. That opposition led to protests against the monarch. In response, the Pahlavi regime launched a brutal crackdown and arrested Imam Khomeini. His detention resulted in an uprising in June 1963. Demonstrators were confronted by tanks and troops armed to the teeth. Thousands were killed. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile, this time because he had opposed the legal immunity the Shah had granted to American military personnel in Iran. He spent over 14 years in exile, mostly in the holy city of Najaf in Iran. But that didn't stop him from criticizing the Shah for making concessions to Western powers, in his view, a violation of Iranian sovereignty. People from all walks of life listened to his speeches via cassettes and distributed his letters, which became the bedrock of a budding revolution. In the early 1970s, Imam Khomeini gave a series of lectures in Najaf on the establishment of a system based on Islamic values. Those lectures were later published as a book under the title Guardianship of the Islamic Jurists. This was his most famous and influential work. It laid out his ideas on a system of governance that would end dictatorship, establish Sharia or Islam's divine law, and would fight injustice, corruption, and oppression. Imam Khomeini's courage, charisma, and popularity opened a new chapter in a grassroots resistance against the Pahlavi regime. Ultimately, on the 16th of January, 1979, the Shah fled Iran, and on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned from Neufeld Le Chateau in France, where he'd been living in exile. 10 days later, Iranians celebrated as their revolution culminated in the overthrow of the US-backed Pahlavi regime. In March 1979, more than 98% of Iranians voted in favor of an Islamic Republic in a referendum. Under such a system proposed by Imam Khomeini, Iran is considered a sovereign country in the form of a republic that implements Islamic laws. A system in marked contrast to the dictatorial Pahlavi regime that was totally dependent on the West, in particular the United States.
Yusuf Jalali has been at a ceremony at Ayatollah Khomeini's mausoleum south of Tehran. He says participants have told him that the late leader still inspires them, four decades after the revolution.
The former Pahlavi regime was highly and heavily dependent on Western powers, who, of course, the Western powers that were present in Iran, trying to exploit the Iranian domestic resources. That is why these people still hold on to those beliefs after more than four decades. So I talked to a lot of people today. Even there were some people with an age of 10 years. They told me, we are here to learn about the character of Imam Khomeini and who Imam Khomeini was, and why their parents continue to commemorate Imam Khomeini still after 43 years. So this is also a gesture. These celebrations are also a gesture to, of course, pass on the messages of the Islamic revolution to the new generation. And it indeed has helped, as we can see that in schools and in universities every year, students also pay tribute to Imam Khomeini and, of course, learn during those celebrations and events about the revolution, why Iranians in their millions rose against the former Pahlavi regime.
Prominent Iranian cleric Ayatollah Lutfullah Golpayegani has passed away at the age of 103. Ayatollah Golpayegani died from a cardiac arrest after staying at a hospital in Qom for the past week. Leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has issued a message of condolence on the demise of the top cleric. Ayatollah Golpayegani was a member of the Assembly of Experts, a body tasked with appointing the leader of the Islamic Revolution, as well as the Constitutional Council that vets candidates for public office. Over his decades-long career, he trained hundreds of researchers and wrote dozens of books. Ayatollah Golpayegani was also a pillar in the field of Islamic jurisprudence, as well as a master in mysticism and practical ethics. Russia says it will not retreat in the face of U.S. threats as Moscow and the West remain locked in a standoff over Ukraine. Russia's embassy in Washington has responded to the recent U.S. sanctions threats. It says that Moscow is not standing at attention and listening to those threats. The White House has said that it is ready to impose sanctions on President Putin's inner circle if Russia attacks Ukraine. The Russian embassy blames Washington for the ongoing tensions. The two countries' top diplomats are set to speak over the phone later on Tuesday. The U.S. and its allies are accusing Russia of planning an imminent invasion of Ukraine. Moscow says it has no plans to start a war, but is demanding binding guarantees that Ukraine won't join NATO. Angry truckers in Canada holding a third day of protests against the government's mandatory COVID vaccination. Major traffic jams persisted in downtown Ottawa Monday as the so-called Freedom Convoy remained in place near the Parliament building. Organizers are calling a logistics nightmare to pressure the government into abandoning vaccine mandates. The convoy arrived in the city on Saturday. Participants want an end to the vaccine mandates for cross-border travel. So far, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has refused to meet with protesters and listen to their demands. He has blasted acts of sabotage and instances of racist imagery during the rally. Turkish people turning out in the city of Istanbul to protest against a planned visit by the Israeli president to their country. The protesters rallied just outside of the Israeli consulate, calling on the government not to host Isaac Herzog. They called Israeli officials baby killers and said the regime has the blood of Palestinian children on their hands. The demonstrators called on Israel to get out of the Palestinian lands. Some of them even called for the annihilation of the Tel Aviv regime.
First of all, Israel is a terrorist entity. It's such a bad thing to invite Israeli President Isaac Herzog to Muslim countries. This is really wrong. It's a blow against Muslims and against the fight for Palestine. We don't want Turkey to invite him. We condemn this invitation. Israel must be destroyed immediately because they are oppressing Palestinians there.
Turkey and Israel have been holding negotiations over a possible natural gas pipeline project. It is not clear, however, whether the project will go ahead. Relations between Ankara and Tel Aviv soured after Israeli Marines stormed a Gaza-bound flotilla in 2010, killing 10 Turkish activists on board. Correspondent in Istanbul, Rashan Saglam, says the hatred among Turkey's people against Israel is rooted in their history.
Turkish people are totally against any kind of relation with Israel, not only those who are, let's call it, religious, not only those who are pro-Arab countries, every Turkish citizen is against any kind of relation with Israel. It's a matter of it goes back to the Ottoman Empire, it goes back to the culture of Turkish people. They hate Israel, they hate the Israeli entity and the Zionist entity. They are against the violations of human rights that is taking place against the Palestinians. They stand with Palestine and Palestinian cause, and they consider Israeli presence in Palestine as an occupation, and they want Israel to get out of Israel, of Palestine. So this those protests that have been going on in Turkey will continue. I think it's on a smaller scale now, but I think it will get more and more in the coming days, and as we get closer to the meeting or the visit of the Israeli president to Turkey.
Israeli forces once again storm into a refugee camp in the occupied territories and detain dozens of Palestinians. We've spoken to our Ramallah correspondent Monica Deal about these latest events. She explains that the Israeli regime has expanded its arrest campaigns across the occupied land.
Israeli forces raided this morning Al-Am'ari refugee camp near Ramallah and arrested at least 21 Palestinians, according to statements coming from Palestinian Prisoners Society and the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs. More Palestinians were detained also in other places, in Bethlehem, in Qalqilia, and in Nablus. The total number of the people who were detained this morning by Israeli forces is 35. But speaking about 21 Palestinians being detained from a very small area, a refugee camp, Al-Am'ari refugee camp, then here's something, let's say, it's weird a little bit. The Israeli military issued a statement yesterday saying that its forces and its military vehicles were exposed to fire from Palestinian fighters in areas in the occupied West Bank and in areas near Ramallah. Maybe this is the reason why the Israeli forces had expanded their arrest campaign across the occupied West Bank, in cities, in refugee camps, in villages. However, Palestinians believe that the Israeli forces don't need excuses to conduct arrests among them.
Sana'a has warned the United Arab Emirates against continuing its aggression against Yemeni people. Head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says persisting in military action, blockade, and efforts to occupy Yemeni territories will endanger the UAE's economy and investments in the country. Mahdi al-Mashat says the recent missile and drone attacks deep inside the UAE demonstrate the Yemeni army's resolve in delivering on its warnings. The Yemeni official insists that the U.S. and Israel cannot protect the aggressors from such retaliatory attacks. The UAE is part of a Saudi-led coalition which has been waging a deadly war in Yemen and keeping it under a crippling blockade since 2015. One of the Saudi-led airstrikes on Sana'a targeted an area near a television building in the city's Al-Thawra district in the early hours of Tuesday. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti says the Yemeni army will press ahead with its retaliatory strikes in Saudi Arabia and the UAE until they end their aggression against Yemen.
I believe that the latest attack on United Arab Emirates is a clear proof that the Yemeni army is well equipped to target United Arab Emirates, and I believe that in the coming days, if not hours, there will be a major attack against United Arab Emirates and as well against Saudi Arabia and Expo in Dubai. It could be as well a target. But I'm sure that Yemeni army, they will step up their attack, because the Yemeni blood is not cheap, and it should meet with a hard attack and wider attack against Saudi and United Arab Emirates as well.
The Yemeni health sector is on the verge of collapse due to years-long Saudi aggression against the country. This has prompted workers in that sector to gather in a protest rally in the capital Sana'a to warn that many health facilities may stop working due to the lack of fuel. Dr. Latifa Washali was there at the event and filed this report.
Yemeni health workers have staged a demonstration inside the Ministry of Health in Yemen's capital Sana'a to warn that over 300 health facilities are on the verge of collapse due to the severe fuel shortage. They slammed the continued detention of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The health sector is suffering greatly due to the lack of fuel, as health officials suffer from a shortage in electrical power generations to save the lives of thousands of patients. Intensive care units, oxygen factories, operation rooms, emergency rooms, and other divisions will stop, and this is a crime against the Yemeni people. Unfortunately, the international community remains silent about what is happening. The United Nations has failed to fulfill its duties.
The Ministry of Health has called on the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels and save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients who may lose their lives as a result of the Saudi blockade on the country.
Banning the entry of fuel ships and piracy on Yemeni oil ships lead to a health catastrophe, as hospitals and health centers are in constant need of fuel. The interruption means that health services will stop working. Some patients come from other governorates to get treatment in Sana'a, such as cancer patients, and the fuel crisis will make their transportation even more difficult. We warn of an imminent health disaster and call on the international community to do its part to save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children.
Recently, the member of Yemen's negotiating delegation Abdul Malik al-Hajri passed away of kidney failure, as he could not travel abroad for treatment due to the continued closure of Sana'a International Airport. That comes as Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015.
The lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Unfortunately, the inaction of the international community towards the catastrophic situation in Yemen is emboldening the Saudi-led coalition to further continue its crimes in the war-ravaged country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Remarks of the leader of the revolution about the 22nd of Bahman. The 22nd of Bahman is the day of the salvation of the Iranian nation and the day of the flourishing and victory of the greatest revolution of our history, from the beginning of Islam to the present day. The period of our history is after Islam, and also in the sense that it is the day of flourishing the talents of our nation and taking advantage of the hardships and sufferings that this nation has endured during its great revolution and during the years of struggle and movement. We, the people of Iran, consider this revolution as our great Eid. Before this revolution, we were societies far from human will, far from Islam, under the domination of foreigners, under the domination of the arrogant. The material condition of our country and the spiritual condition of this nation were both bad. Our revolution began in the name of God and with the help and assistance of God for the victory of Islam and the elimination of oppression, and was achieved by enduring hardships for 15 years and more. On the first day of the victory of this revolution, we all said, and all the nations believed, that this work will not end with the victory of the American people in our country. The work will not end on February 13th, but the work will start on this great and happy day. On the 22nd of Bahman, we set foot on the paths that the end of this path is an Islamic and human society that is comfortable, full of blessings, and equal to the command of God and the divine laws. We will gradually get closer to it. The 22nd of Bahman is a real holiday for our nation. The 22nd of Bahman is for our nation as the Eid al-Fitr, in which the nation came out of a difficult period of fasting, a time when they had imposed deprivation of spiritual and material nourishment on our nation. The 22nd of Bahman is the ruling of Eid al-Adha. The 22nd of Bahman is the ruling of Eid al-Qadir. Because it was on that day that the blessings of the province, the completion of the blessings and the completion of the divine blessings, became practical for the Iranian nation and a foreign realization. The march on the 22nd of Bahman must be done with greatness. Be careful not to hold a march or rally, however small, before the 22nd of Bahman. Keep in mind to ban such marches. If a certain group wants to march in a certain place, it should be after the 22nd of Bahman. On the 22nd of Bahman, the whole country should suddenly explode and people should take to the streets.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Jeddah is the second largest city in Saudi Arabia and is home to 4.5 million people. Since late October, at least a million people in Jeddah have had their lives turned upside down amid a large-scale demolition push by the government. Residents say the demolitions have taken them by surprise and given them little to no room to plan their relocation because it was on short notice. The displacement has caused a housing crisis, with rental prices skyrocketing across the city. In some cases, rents have doubled in a matter of days and many aren't able to afford them. At least 10 neighborhoods have been completely wiped out so far, as work continues in around another 10 areas. The plan targets some 60 districts, mostly located in the city's southern part, and is expected to continue for months. Online footage and satellite images show the wide-scale destruction of entire neighborhoods, which have been turned into dust. In 2020, similar demolitions carried out in the northern Tabuk province made international headlines. Saudi Arabia's Al-Huwaitat tribe sent an urgent communication to the United Nations, calling for an investigation into allegations of forced displacement and abuse by Saudi authorities. Their request came after months of alleged harassment, arrests, and abductions by the Saudi forces, apparently due to the tribe's refusal to relocate to facilitate the government's Neom megacity project. Also, Saudi security forces killed an Al-Huwaitat tribe member, Abdulrahim Ahmad Mahmoud Al-Huwaiti, who was an activist protesting his eviction. He had also denounced the Neom project on several occasions. At least 20,000 members of the tribe now face eviction due to the project, with no information about where they will live in the future.
And they've even destroyed most of the religious monuments of people like the prophet, peace upon him, and his household. So this just bulldozing history and bulldozing tradition is really in their blood. So I'm not that surprised that they're doing this kind of nuclear scale urban renewal, so-called project in Jeddah.
The Saudi Crown Prince's desert dream, Neom, is due to completion in 2025 on Tabuk's Red Sea coast. It's a city designed to attract international investors, but has been subject to scrutiny since it was announced in 2017. With critics calling it wasteful and inefficient in addressing the problems of the Saudi economy, including unemployment and dependence on oil. Currently, over 11% of Saudi citizens are unemployed. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's oil sector still contributes up to 80% of the country's budget revenues, while 88% of Saudi Arabia's foreign income is from oil exports. Details of the Neom project prompted a flurry of reactions when it was first announced, as people accused Mohammed bin Salman of using extravagant technology to cover up the kingdom's human rights abuses. Ever since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has ramped up arrests of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others perceived as political opponents, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnations of the crackdown. The destruction of communities on the Neom side follows decades of tensions between the House of Saud and the tribes it has ruled over since the creation of the Saudi state in 1932. Exerting control over the land through construction projects or destruction of some heritage sites have marked this rule. In 2017, the UN condemned the kingdom's forced demolition of the walled city of Awamiya in the eastern Katif region as violating human rights.
The United States military has come under intense scrutiny over its procedures to guard against civilian casualties after a high-profile mistaken drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, that claimed the lives of 10 civilians, including 7 children, on August 29. The U.S. military initially said it successfully targeted a Daesh terrorist who was linked to the attack on the Kabul airport that killed over 100 people, including 13 U.S. troops. The latest study by the RAND Corporation think tank concluded that systemic weaknesses at the Department of Defense were resulting in it falling short of its duties on civilian casualties. It added that in conflicts, the U.S. military's access to targeted areas is limited both before and after strikes, and it relies on intelligence gathered remotely using sources like drone surveillance and satellite imagery.
Well, the United States regularly violates its own and international laws about related to war, but I do think the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its use of drones entirely. We know because of brave whistleblowers like Daniel Hale and other journalists who have reported on drones and drone use that the U.S. often uses faulty intelligence to conduct these strikes, which do result in lots of civilian casualties.
The RAND study, which was required by congressional legislation, found that the problem is compounded by the US military when it fails to adequately talk to people from outside the US government or armed forces who might have access to information on the ground. After the RAND study was released, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued a memorandum calling for the creation of a plan on civilian harm mitigation and response in the months to come, as well as the creation of Civilian Protection Center later this year. A senior Pentagon official later admitted that the department's data gathering strategies have been faulty and expressed the need to incorporate the figures from other sources in American tallies. The U.S. runs nearly 700 overseas military bases in at least 80 countries around the world. Such widespread military presence means that Washington has been involved in many wars, either covertly or overtly, to secure its interests. Those wars almost always result in many civilian casualties. The question is how the U.S. is planning to reduce the number of civilians who pay the cost of the war on their country with their lives.
Yeah, I think for many reasons the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its foreign policy. We need to move away from war, first and foremost, because of the impact it has internationally on countries like Yemen and Afghanistan and other countries the U.S. has been involved in a war inside of in the last few years. Also, the environmental impact of war. War and militarism is driving the climate crisis. And also, we need to do things in the United States, like cut the Pentagon budget to move us away from war and put more money towards things that actually matter, like free healthcare for all Americans and that sort of thing.
That being said, the simplest solution to the problem of civilian casualties overseas seems to be not conducting any such operations in the first place, as the U.S. military's track record in accepting accountability is far from acceptable, and at the same time, the countries where the U.S. has deployed troops in are calling for their withdrawal.
Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists used explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism, but in reality it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halted support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Utaina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Mali's government has called on Denmark to immediately withdraw troops deployed to the West African nation. Malian officials say the reason to ask Copenhagen for the troops' withdrawal is because officials in Bamako were not consulted and the deployment failed to follow protocol. Mali says all troops' deployments in the country need a prior accord with the government before deployments in the African nation. The decision comes amid tension between Mali and regional bodies and the European Union that have sanctioned Mali after the transitional government failed to organize elections following two military coups.
Danish forces, without identifying themselves to Malian authorities, committed a huge breach in regard to their internal security and also diplomatic relations between the two countries.
About 90 personnel, including sergeants and special forces, and logistic support, were deployed in Mali. Their mandate was supposed to last until early 2023. They were part of Takuba Task Force, which is made up of European special forces. It's based on an initiative by France. Takuba's 900 soldiers are to help Mali's army acquire the combat skills necessary to become self-reliant.
It's a very outrageous situation. I think they are victims of European imperialist intervention. France, which is a former colonial power, intervened 9 years ago, yet the security situation inside the country is far worse than it was in 2013.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 with the purported aim of countering militants linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France is a former colonizer of Africa. It has deployed thousands of soldiers to presumably prevent separatist forces from reaching Mali's capital, Bamako. In December, Paris withdrew from northern Mali and the city of Timbuktu, 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or the French Parliament.
I do believe that France, you know, has committed grave errors in regard to its intervention in Mali. And
the war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. The withdrawal came amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence in Mali, which has been wracked by two military coups in little over a year.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed Over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries, including Burkina Faso. At the same time, we have a new rash of military interventions and seizures of power in all of these Sahel countries.
France has been one of the world's colonizing countries that, after many years of slavery, still controls countries spread over more than 12 territories and treats their people as second-class citizens. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of its former colonies gained independence.
Brutality prevails, and that is the imperialist hegemony seeking to extend its influence and maintain its influence internationally.
Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of resources. France currently has 5,100 troops in the arid and volatile Sahel region. Under a new plan, they will be reduced to up to 3,000 troops. Analysts say it's premature to call it the end of France's military intervention in Africa, believing Paris is only readjusting its post-colonial plans.
فارس و هرمز شانه به شانه سلسل کوه الباز وسعت نام تو وسعت نام خورشید جلوه خاک تو قرمز و سبز و سپید نمنم من نمن منم من ذره خاک وطنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ایران خاک دلیران ایران کنام شیران ایران همیشه جاویدان.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist,
a champion of the people and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: لا تجعلن ذرب لسانك على من أنطقك، وبلاغة قولك على من سددك.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "Do not try the sharpness of your tongue against him who gave you the power to speak, nor the eloquence of your speaking against him who set you on the right path."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So, dear friends, one of the very interesting and beautiful things that we see about the infallible Imams is that their persona is totally universal, meaning their persona is applicable to every age and every time, and no matter how much time passes, this persona of these beautiful infallibles is such that everybody can apply their manners and their behaviors and their sayings in their own personal lives. And the teachings that were taught by these infallible Imams is applicable to us as well. Now, sometimes we kind of wonder, well, what is the biggest sin? Right amongst our friends or perhaps in a conversation with our family members, we tend to wonder or we question each other what we think is the biggest sin. Now, it's interesting that we might have differences of opinion on what exactly the biggest sin is. For example, we could say lying is the biggest sin, or we can say cheating somebody is the biggest sin, or for example, we can say slander is the biggest sin, or gossip is the biggest sin. Here we find a very beautiful saying from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he talks about this biggest sin. And he tells all of us, what is this biggest sin? Imam Ali alayhi salam, this truly universal persona, says that a human being's ignorance of their faults is their biggest sin. Dear friends, it's so really amazing and perhaps even a little strange. We would not think that being ignorant of our own faults would be a big sin. But when we look a little bit deeper into this statement of Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course we find that it is true. When a human being ignores their own faults, right, this is a big sin. At times we tend to point out the faults of other people quite easily. That too. We say this person has this problem and that person has that problem. And very rarely do we ever look within ourselves to try to find what are the faults that we have. And so to ignore your own faults, now this doesn't mean to not know, to ignore one's fault is truly the biggest sin. When we are ignorant about our faults, one, we never find out what they are, and thus we can never fix them. Two, if we are ignorant about our faults, that means that we're not bothering to reassess ourselves and evaluate ourselves to see what is wrong with us. And so, yes, truly, as Imam Ali says, man's ignorance, a human being's ignorance of their own faults, is truly their biggest sin. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the truly universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
كل صبح وكل شراب أيام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاب أيام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا رغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And these are the words of Ali, where he says, لا يقاس بآل محمد من هذه الأمة أحد. No one in this ummah can be compared to the family of the Prophet. The problem with Dr. Taha al-Qadiri is this. When they put Ali on the same level as others, and that is injustice to Ali himself. And Ali says, لا يقاس. Nobody from the Ummah should be brought on the same level as Ali Muhammad. Why? ولا يسوى بهم من جرت نعمتهم عليه عبدا. The one who is under their obligation cannot ever be equal to them. What is Ali saying here? The blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala comes to the Ummah through the intermediary of Ali Muhammad. They are the wasita phase, where they are the link between the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Muslims. And if they are the link, they are superior to the rest of the Ummah. And so it would not be right to compare anyone from the Ummah with Ali Muhammad. So Ali Muhammad and Ummah Muhammad are not on the same level. And we don't have to go very far. Look at Salat. In Tashahud, what do? We recite the testimony of Tawheed of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then we testify to the Nubuwwat of Rasulullah. What do Muslims across the board, what do they do after that? They recite Salawat on Muhammad and Ali Muhammad in their namaz. They are worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But nobody can say that I will replace it one day and say Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ashabihi, or Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa azwajihi, or Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ummatihi. No, it has to be Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Imam Ahmad bin Hanbal, the founder of the Hanbali fiqh of Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah, because of some of his views, people used to say that, oh, he is kind of sympathetic towards Yazid. And he always used to be very defensive on this issue that it is not true. And therefore, his son would ask many sensitive questions of this type. One day his son of Ahmad bin Hanbal, he came to the father and he says, oh my father, who is the best in the Ummah after Rasulullah? And automatically, you know, Ahmad bin Hanbal mentioned the name of the first three Khulafa, one after another. And the son was waiting to hear the name of Ali as the fourth one. But time passed, there was silence. And so now the son says, what about Ali? Imam Ahmad bin Hanbal says to his son, he says, you asked me about the Ummah of Muhammad, and Ali is from Ahl Bayt of Muhammad. Different categories. You were asking me about the Ummah and companions, and Ali is not part of that. He is in a different category. He is part of the Ali Muhammad and Ahl Bayt Muhammad. And then Ali goes on to say, "Hum asasuddin wa imadul yaqeen." And they are the foundation of religion and the pillar of conviction. Ilayhim yafi'ul ghali wa bihim yalhaqut tali. He says, Ahlul Bayt are the measure and the standard. The ghali, those who exaggerate issues about Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, they have to stop and come back to them. And those who put down the Ahlul Bayt, they have to move forward and reach to the Ahlul Bayt. Because that is the true criteria and the status and the standard of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Salawatullah Majmay.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
The bloody war in Yemen is back in the news.
In recent weeks, the Saudi-led coalition has tightened the noose around the poorest country in the region. In late January, the coalition targeted a detention center, claiming some 70 people and wounding many more. It also hit a telecommunications center, knocking the country off the internet. The Saudis have speeded up their aggression since October, after the UN Human Rights Council voted to end its war crimes investigation following intensive lockdowns.